Welcome to Casting Hope, a sermon podcast of Hope Presbyterian Church in Columbus, Ohio. My name is Joe Hack, pastor at Hope, and we are so glad that you are listening in. We would love to connect with you in person at our Sunday gathering. In the meantime, we hope this message points you to Jesus, the reason we gather.
We wanted to express that we are so glad that you're here. It really cannot be overstated that it can be difficult to make it to church on Sunday morning, particularly in a place with people that you've never been before. And so we hope that you experience at least a taste of the welcome of Jesus with us this morning. This morning is Epiphany Sunday. This is a Sunday in the church calendar after the Christmas season that the church has remembered something particular about the revelation of Jesus to our world. We remember that Jesus was not revealed in secret only to the people of Israel, but that the incarnation of the Son of God changes everything because God's grace is extended to people from all people groups around the world, all ethnicities, all cultures, all languages, people from any religious background. This grace is extended and welcomed to people everywhere. And Epiphany is a week in the calendar of the year when God's people all around the world remember and appreciate God's light shining upon us. And we continue our series in the Gospel of Luke. And I think you'll see when we unpack this passage how our passage this morning connects really closely with this theme of Epiphany. But before we dive into the passage, I wanted to share a little bit from my own story. I graduated from Ohio State. And when I graduated from Ohio State, I did something a little bit uncommon, I would say, because I moved to Sao Paulo, Brazil for 2 years. And I did that with an organization called CRU, helping to start campus ministries at the University of Sao Paulo. And when I was getting ready to leave, as can sometimes happen with these sorts of things, I ran into some visa troubles. My teammates all got their visas, and they were all able to go on time, and I was left behind. And I had to kind of wonder what their experiences were like. This was back in the day when email was maybe the most modern form of communication, right? There wasn't a ton, social media did not exist. So I was just kind of hoping they were doing fine. When the visa finally came in and I was able to go down to Brazil and join up with my teammates, my very first night in Brazil, they took me to a restaurant that they had found called Fogo de Chão, which means fire of the ground. The reason I'm mentioning this restaurant is because if you've ever been, you know that it may be the most glorious meal you will ever have. They are slowly expanding across the U.S. now, actually, and I heard rumors that they may end up in Columbus someday, which would be a dream come true, but I want to paint a picture for you of what this was like. This is my first meal entering into a place that I had never been before. Picture men in cowboy suits, basically, bringing steak as much as you can eat. Some of the most perfectly seasoned steak, as much as you want, all night. I had never dreamed that anything like this could exist. Going into this new place made me realize that I had been missing something my whole life that I didn't know existed. But it wasn't just that. Soon after, we went on a little weekend vacation to an island right off the coast of the Bill called Ilha Bela, the beautiful isle. And there's no bridge that crosses. You have to take a ferry. Later in that day, I found myself underneath a tropical waterfall It felt like I was living in a fairy tale, quite honestly. But it wasn't just these experiences. I got to experience the beauty of Brazilian culture, of language, and of people. I can still remember the students that I got to meet, Thais, Bruna, Flavio, how they were, God was at work in their life, that their faith was deepening. But there was also challenges that came from this great experience, because I was very far away from friends and family back here. There was a ton of distance, not just geographically, but relationally. Things were happening in people's lives back home during these 2 years that I missed out on. And there was also the pain of loneliness, a pain that I couldn't anticipate, a pain that felt so tremendously acute so often while I was there. I share this because I want to say that sometimes to receive a good gift from God, it requires also accepting the pain that comes with it. To experience life-changing good from God sometimes means that we have to accept that there's a cost. And as we look at this passage this morning, what we can wrestle with is, are we willing to accept the pain that can come from the life-changing, life-altering good news of the gospel in Jesus Christ? So as we begin unpacking this passage from Luke this morning, we remember that it's Epiphany, and this comes with unspeakable glory and pain. And what we see in our passage is that ordinary faithfulness always matters. Ordinary faithfulness always matters. So in verse 21, it says, "On the eighth day, when it was time to circumcise the child, he was named Jesus, the name the angel had given him before he was conceived. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as it is written in the law of the Lord. Every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or two young pigeons." And then at the very close of our passage, Luke wants us to see that this theme of Mary and Joseph's ordinary faithfulness continues through. At the end of this passage, Luke says, "When Joseph and Mary had done everything required by the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee, to their town, their own town of Nazareth. And the child grew and became strong. He was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was on him." See, Joseph and Mary, they're not called to be extraordinary parents. They don't need to do anything flashy in our passage this morning. Nothing extra special. We don't see them fasting for 40 days in the wilderness. We do not see them donating billions of dollars to feed the unhoused. In fact, they're poor themselves. What they simply have to do is to be ordinary parents, fulfilling what any parent was called to do in ancient Israel. And in so many ways, this is a mystery to us, because when we think about later on in the Gospels, as Jesus is teaching, he says that he has not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. But in the mystery of the incarnation, this baby is not old enough to make decisions about whether or not he would fulfill the law. But he grows up under parents who faithfully follow the Lord's ways, even when he cannot. In ways we cannot totally and fully understand, ordinary faithfulness matters. There's a theologian named Michael Horton who became concerned years ago of a trend that he saw in many evangelical churches and parachurches across the country, because he saw so many Christian leaders loudly proclaiming from the mountaintops that Christians needed to be more radical. They needed to be increasingly radical. And though Horton would agree that sometimes we do need to reject the idol of our comfort, he also recognizes that this call to be a radical Christian has its own pitfalls. Listen to what he has to say. He says, "I'm convinced that we have drifted from the true focus of God's activity in this world. It is not to be found in the extraordinary, but in the ordinary, the everyday. The problem is not that we are too active, but that we are recklessly frenetic. We have grown accustomed to quick fixes and easy solutions. We've grown accustomed to running sprints instead of training for the long distance marathon. We have plenty of energy. The danger is that we will burn ourselves out on restless anxieties and unrealistic expectations. But we are called to do every day right where God has placed us is rich and rewarding. What we see in Mary and in Joseph is ordinary faithfulness, doing what any other parent in ancient Israel would do for their firstborn child. And yet that ordinary faithfulness mysteriously matters more than we can understand. The same is true for us. Secondly, being with God positions us to see what God sees. Being with God positions us to see what God sees. There are two characters in our text this morning that we do not see other places in the New Testament, but they model to us what it means to be with God. Now, there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon, who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was on him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Messiah. Moved by the Spirit, he went into the temple courts. And later on in the passage, we meet Anna. There was also a prophet, Anna, the daughter of Penuel of the tribe of Asher. She was very old. She had lived with her husband 7 years after her marriage, and then was a widow until she was 84. She never left the temple, but worshipped night and day, fasting and praying. See, we see these two parallel stories from two relatively obscure characters in the Gospel of Luke, Simeon and Anna. They have some things in common. One of them is that they do not appear to have easy lives. Simeon is described as waiting for consolation, waiting for the consolation of Israel, of which he is a part. Someone who is waiting for consolation is in need. We also see Anna. She has been widowed for decades. year after year. So life is not painless for Simeon or for Anna. They do not have easy lives, per se. But another thing that they have in common is that they come to the temple regularly to pray, to worship, and to be with God. They desire to commune with God, to live faithfully. But there is a significant difference between Simeon and Anna in this passage, and this is a quick aside, but it's worth pointing out. Only one of them in this passage is described as a prophet, as one who hears from God and speaks for God. And that's Anna. See, this role of prophet in ancient Israel, it does not map easily onto most churches' leadership structures today. But Luke doesn't throw around that word willy-nilly. To be called a prophet in these days was a significant description. Luke wants his readers to see that this woman, Anna, is recognized as having a gifting and a role in her community. But in a way, they're both prophetic. Both Simeon and Anna, in ordinary ways, they exhibit ordinary spiritual disciplines. They want to be with God. And this being with God helps them to see what they couldn't otherwise see. Because how many families over all those years in the temple courts had come through? How many children had they seen? Probably countless. And yet, they recognized there was something different about Jesus. It was their ordinary spiritual disciplines of prayer and being with God, worshiping Him day after day, year after year, that positioned them to see what God sees. There's a pastor in New York City named Rich Velodas, and he says this about prayer. He says, "In silent prayer, we are constantly called to let go of the need to achieve mastery or to perform well. Whenever I hear of people being recognized spiritual masters or masters of prayer, I don't think of them as people who have some kind of secret sauce that makes their prayer life extraordinary. I think of them as people who have determined day in and day out to return to the simple act of being with God. There is no such thing as being professionals at prayer. We are always beginners." And so, in so many ways, Simeon and Anna both are a snapshot. They are a picture of exactly what Rich Velodas is talking about. Just the simple day in and day out being with God positions them to see what the Spirit reveals to them in Jesus. And what do they see when they see this baby Jesus come into the temple courts? What do they see? Well, they see that Jesus changes everything. And that is glorious, but it is not always easy. When the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him what the custom of the law required, Simeon took him in his arms and praised God, saying, "Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the sight of all nations, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people, Israel." The child's father and mother marveled at what was said about him. Then Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed and a sword will pierce your own soul too." What did Anna see when she saw Jesus? When the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him what the custom of the law required, Simeon took him in his arms, praising God, saying, "Sovereign Lord, as you..." Let's continue on here. It says, "She, Anna, gave thanks to God and spoke about the child to all who were looking forward to the redemption of Jerusalem." So Simeon and Anna both have been waiting. They've been longing. They've been seeking God's face for years. And the appearance of this baby boy in the temple means that everything is changing. Jesus changes everything. We see really significant words in this passage. We see that Jesus brings peace. Jesus brings salvation. Jesus is light. Jesus is glory for Israel. And Anna sees that in Jesus is redemption. Jesus changes everything. And this is the day, as I mentioned earlier, on the church calendar that we celebrate Epiphany. And we see in this passage that Simeon recognizes that Jesus is a light not only to Israel, but to all nations. Jesus changes everything for the better. He is the climax of God's story. And for Mary, she must also be prepared from the very beginning of parenting Jesus, that the cross will precede the crown. She will have to witness the torture and the death of her son. Arguably one of the greatest works of art in human history has been called the Pietà by Michelangelo. And if you've been to the Vatican in Rome, you know that it's possible to spend hours observing this piece of art. Michelangelo was likewise apparently captivated by this moment in Mary's life where a sword pierced her soul. The Messiah, the Son of God, her own Son, the revelation of who God is, dead from the cross. Writer Ken Geyer is himself captivated by this piece of art, and he's written a book called Shaped by the Cross. And in this book, he imagines Michelangelo chipping away at this marble rock to set free the image that is contained inside in his imagination. And he wonders, are there ways that this chipping away of the marble serves as a metaphor for how God forms us into the image of Jesus? Does God use what is painful to make us beautiful in the end? And in his book, he provides a prayer, which I will invite you now to quietly meditate on. And if you would, pray quietly with me. Dear Lord, thank you for all I am predestined to become. and for your persistence in seeing that I become it. Help me to understand that the more the marble wastes, the more the statue grows. Help me to love the person I am becoming more than I long for the person I am losing. It is difficult to process, Lord, this losing of the self. And sometimes I can't understand what you are doing in my life. Help me to see that in the difficult are the friendly forces, the hands that work on us. More than I fear the hammer that is wielded against me, help me to love the hand that holds the hammer and keeps it from crushing me. More than I doubt the chisel that gouges me, help me to trust the hand that guides the chisel and uses it to shape me into the beautiful image of Christ. It's in His name I pray. Amen. This revelation of Jesus is more glorious than we can comprehend. And there is pain that can come with following Him. And because of His resurrection, it is worth it. It's always worth it.
Thanks for listening in. For more resources like this and to learn more about Hope, please visit our website at hopechurchcolumbus.org.